I want to continue with this first shloka. I should say that it had originally been my aim that we would be able to, during this week, to get through the first four shlokas, but I'm sure that's not going to be possible. So we will do what we can still with the first shloka, and tomorrow I thought I'd break the pattern a little bit by sharing some of the myths dealing with what HPB later calls these prehistoric, she calls them antediluvian astronomers, because I think it's rather interesting and it will break the heavy work a little bit to introduce a couple of myths which have to do with this very early period. As you know, I'm fascinated by mythology, and so whenever possible, it's fun to introduce some of the myths that have to do with this particular very early section in our studies. Now, yesterday, there's Arlene. Yesterday we were discussing, as I say, this whole pattern that we saw develop. Now, there's a further sentence in the first shloka which continues this story, and I want to start in with that. You remember that we have the law which turns the fourth, that is the planetary guardian, regent, rector, which turns this globe, the fourth, which is the fourth in the planetary chain, is subservient to the laws of the seven. We'll come back to this. That is the planetary spirits, that every one of the globes in the planetary chain, there being seven globes, each one has its Dhyani, its lord, its regent, law, lord, watcher. They who revolve, and it's interesting that if you think that the knowledge of the rotation of the planets on their axes is only known since Copernicus in the West. This is not true. One has this even in the Rig Veda, the oldest of the scriptures. One has it in many mythologies, in fact, this revolution. I'll come to that in a moment with a fascinating book that that Ruth Jurgensen has just brought to me. It's all in Spanish, so she's translating it into English. We'll come back to that in a moment. But in other words, the watcher of our planet, the Dhyani of our globe, is subservient to the watchers of the other globes and to preceding chains. They who revolve, driving their chariots around their lord. So here, driving their globes, their chariots, their vehicles, the chariot in which they ride, as it were, around their lord, the one eye of our world, which is the sun in mystical sense. His breath gave life to the seven, that is, gives light to the planets. It gave light to the first, and it's at that point the sun gave light to the first, that I'd like to take up our story today. Because again, we have the basis of a pattern, since the first can apply to many levels, you see. So the sun gives light to the first, this mystical planet, not our solar sun necessarily. Please remember that in this, although it can also be that, but it has a number of layers of meaning, and it can refer to at least seven, and I've put it as seven. Barborka gives it in this seven applications. And I think really we have to be aware that this sevening is indeed a very basic to our whole system. Everything is in sevens. And it's extremely basic, and HPB dwells on this in speaking of numbers, that the number seven is the fundamental figure among all other figures in every national religious system, from cosmogony down to man. This is page 34 of volume 2. It is found among the ancient Americans as prominently as among the archaic Aryans and Egyptians. And she quotes, as Ruth may know, from the work by Augustus Le Plongeon, Sacred Mysteries Among the Mayas and Quiches. Quiches. And some of you may have been here when Ruth Jurgensen gave us that fascinating seminar on the Quiche Maya Indians, which was really marvelous. And very interesting that the Mayas belonged in the fifth continent, HPB suggests, and so on. And we'll come back to that. But this sevening is very important. So we can see how this applies. This sentence in the shloka, again giving us a pattern, it applies to the first humanity on earth during the first round. It can apply to the first land in the fourth round. And when I say first land, put land in quotes if you like, because it's not a physical land mass, and we'll come to that, probably not this time, but when I take up the studies again of the sacred doctrine, it, of course, refers to the imperishable sacred land, which is not a land mass, I suggest, but rather is a kind of ethereal or etheric or mold vehicle of what will eventually physicalize. It's a nice word, physicalize. Just made that up. I don't see why Virginia will say it's not in the dictionary. Well, I've not. I've just made it up. Isn't it all right? Physicalize. Yes, you will tell me it's not a word, but it's a nice word. All right. So it can apply to this first land in the fourth round. It can apply to the first planetary manifestation of the system, which is now represented by, of course, the Earth chain. It can apply to the first globe of the Earth chain. And in fact, we have on pages 18 and 19 of this volume 2, this is back in the stanzas themselves, the globe propelled onward by the spirit of the earth and his six assistants gets all its vital forces, life, and powers through the medium of the seven planetary dhyanis from the spirit of the sun. They are his messengers of light and life. So we have, excuse me, pages 28, 29, not 18, 19. It's in the occult commentary, pages 28, 29. The globe, propelled onward by the spirit of the earth and his six assistants, gets all its vital forces, life, and powers through the medium of the seven planetary dhyanis from the spirit of the sun. They are his messengers of light and life. So it can apply to the first globe of the earth chain. It can apply to the first region, the first of the seven regions of the earth in the fourth round. And you remember one of the first fundamental proposition of this second series is the simultaneous evolution of seven human groups on seven regions. And we have this later in one of the shlokas, that the moon gods went each, the seven went each to their allotted they went each on his allotted land, seven of them, each on his lot. That's shloka 13 in this series. So it's the first, then, of the regions. Since each of the regions, these seven regions, as they're called, and this is page 29 of volume 2, receives its light and life from its own especial dhyani, spiritually, and from the palace, or house, planet, each planet having a house, of that dhyani physically, it can apply to the first race in the fourth round, because, again, quoting volume 2, pages 23-24, every race in its evolution is said to be born under the direct influence of one of the planets, race the first receiving its breath from the sun. So it can apply to the first race because it receives its breath from the sun. And it can can apply to the first of the seven sacred planets. Since, as we also read in that occult commentary, page 29, every active power or force of the earth comes to her from one of the seven lords, and that's the seven sacred planets. So we have, again, this pattern. Isn't it marvelous? The pattern is there, repeated in hierarchical order. There's a marvelous passage to this effect, too, in HPB's essay in volume 5 of the Adyar edition, that esoteric writings in the Quest edition, the essay on the doctrine of the avatars. I think Peter asked yesterday about the avatars. This is a marvelous passage. It's on pages 356 and 7 of volume 5, if you have the Adyar edition. It's on pages 296 and 7 of that paperback, The Esoteric Writings. And it's a marvelous passage in which HPB says, the reader may now be able to obtain a clearer comprehension of the whole thing. It's always, I always prick up my ears when she says, now you get a clearer comprehension, and she proceeds to go into further depths. He will also see what is meant by the watchers, there being one placed as the guardian or regent over each of the seven divisions or regions of the earth, according to old traditions, as there is one to watch over and guide every one of the 14 worlds or lokas. And she says this is the secret meaning of the statements about the hierarchy of Prajapatis or Rishis. And this is interesting because this, of course, also Prajapati, as one of the deities in the Hindu pantheon, was the one also who is cut up into 100 pieces and distributed. Rather interesting, because generally in Hindu mythology, where one finds these terms, 100 or a crore or any of these things. I always remember during my period at Adyar having to, of course, deal with our financial statements and a crore of rupees or a lakh of rupees. And, one of the first things I had to find out was what was meant by all of this, because, it was just to me a sort of pail of rupees being carried in, sort of thing. So one has this hierarchy, as she says, this is a secret meaning, gods, creators of men, many of them lords of being, there are the mind-born sons and so on. But she continues then and gives us another commentary in this passage on the doctrine of avatars. or another commentary on the book of John says, descending on his region first as Lord of glory, the flame or breath, having called into conscious being the highest of the emanations of that special region, ascends from it again to its primeval seat, whence it watches over and guides its countless beams, monads. So it actually, as it were, calls into being the highest of the emanations of that region. We'll come to that in a moment. But then returns, as it were, to preside over and guide and nurture, perhaps is a good word, all of its countless beings who are the monads. It chooses as its avatars only those who had the seven virtues in them in their previous incarnation. As for the rest, it overshadows each with one of its countless beams, yet even the beam is a part of the Lord of Lords. The title, of course, of the highest, Dian Chohans. So it's, again, one of those very marvelous passages. We could spend a great deal of time in its interpretation, but think about it. Think about its meaning. And in the section also in this volume, page 333 in the fifth volume and page 277 in the esoteric writings, that other reproduction of this, in the section on astrology and astrolottery, we read, as our sun radiates its light and beams on every body in space within the boundaries of its system, so the regent of every planet star, the planet monad, shoots out from itself the monad of every pilgrim soul born under its house within its own group. So that we can, I think, correlate this, of course, with also what we have called the seven rays very clearly. And therefore, it is, as it were, the Dhyani who awakens all of the humanity that will continue its pilgrim journey, but under its house within its own group, these seven groups simultaneously present. Well, this brings us again with the seven sacred planets. We have the septenary pattern. Now, it's not because the ancients knew of only seven planets, and therefore we have to continue to fit all of our knowledge into the confines of the septenate, but because that number, as HPV is very clear, is the basis for our system for manifestation from the unmanifest. And indeed, HPV states very clearly and succinctly that seven, or the heptad, is, and this is page 602 of volume 2, the perfect and sacred number of this Mahamanvantara of ours. And I think she has a section indeed, it's a section in volume 2 in the latter portion where she deals with everything dealing with the heptad, the sevens, the sevening, some wonderful material that is in that. Yes, the mysteries of the hebdomad, which is the, of course, from the Saptaparna, the septenary element in the Vedas, and the seven souls of the Egyptologists, and so on. So she's not saying there were only seven planets, and certainly the ancients knew of more planets. But therefore, this is limited, as she says herself, and she shows the prominence of that number, as I say, in many traditions, and concludes, this is again page 602 in volume 2, that cis-Himalayan occultism with its sevening, and because of such sevening, must be regarded as the most ancient, the original of all. And consequently, as she puts in a footnote, the seven planets are not limited to this number because the ancients knew no others, but simply because they were primitive or primordial houses of the seven logoi. There may be 9 and 99 other planets discovered. This does not alter the fact of these seven alone being sacred. So what we're looking at is not planets that we see through the telescopes at night, but rather what they represent in terms of mystical, their mystical signification. And this, I suggest, is the true basis of astrology. Would you agree? I mean, this is really its fundamental basis.
May I mention, yes, the seventh, the Mayans also found out through their studies of the universe that the earth is going to be destroyed, and humanity and the animals on the earth going to be destroyed seven times.
Seven,
we had,
yes,
already four times. We are getting into the fourth.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth.
The
fourth,
mm-hmm,
was the water.
Mm-hmm.
By water
that was the Atlantean deluge.
Yeah.
Begin to see this. With the new theory, the geological theory of tectonic plates, which I think is an extremely interesting one that helps us in many ways. Of course, that was not a theory when HPB was writing, but I think it's more, and as I understand it, I better put it that way, it's more and more accepted today among geologists as the basic manner in which the continental land masses shift and change and so on. And I think it has a great deal of meaning because we already know that portions of the East Coast, New York City, I'm sorry to say, Anna, is gradually slipping away. And, you know, the Big Apple has quite a chunk taken out of it along the coastline. And so we know that there is, of course, this is measurable now, some of the changes in the land masses. Well, now if we ask, of course, why this subject of the seven sacred planets is important for our study of the evolutionary development of humanity, we can point to a very significant statement that occurs in volume one of The Secret Doctrine. This is page 575 of volume 1, and also the footnote to that. But there it says, the seven sons of light, namely Saturn, Jupiter, Mercury, Mars, Venus, and the sun and moon, and of course later we discover these are substitutes for two which are not named, the sun and moon, which are according to the occult teachings our heavenly parents or father synthetically. Saturn, Jupiter, Mercury, and Venus, the four exoteric planets, and three others which must remain unnamed, were the heavenly bodies in direct astral and psychic communication with the earth, its guides and watchers, morally and physically. The visible orbs furnishing our humanity with its outward and inward characteristics, and their regents or rectors with our monads and spiritual faculties. Tremendous statement. The visible orbs furnishing our, now again, when she says visible orbs, and I think what we need to recognize, maybe I can put it this way, at least as I see it, it's not that the sun was in a certain place in Libra, which is under the rule of which planet?
Venus
isn't it? Yeah. That's where I always need you, because I always forget these things. that Joy Mills was born in this incarnation. It's not that that happened, that this caused my birth. But, you know, I mean, I think sometimes this gets to being a sort of thing, but rather that there is what Jung calls, of course, a synchronicity, in which there is an effect throughout the universe. And consequently, I have certain characteristics as a result of this particular vibratory radiation, can I put it that way? You see. And so I think we have to see that when she says visible orbs furnishing our humanity with its outward and inward characteristics, it's that they are visible to us as planets, but they represent in their essence qualities or faculties or particular, because of the dhyanis, the regents of those areas, lokas, spheres, therefore certain qualities, certain characteristics are bestowed upon us. And their regents or rectors, therefore, are very intimately connected with our monads and spiritual faculties. Now, in the same section of Volume 1, page 578, HBB tells us that every heavenly body is the temple of a god, and these gods themselves are the temples of God, capital G, capital O, capital D. So, as she says, the planets are not merely spheres twinkling in space and made to shine for no purpose, but the domains of various beings with whom the profane are so far unacquainted. Nevertheless, having a mysterious, unbroken, and powerful connection with men and globes. So these sacred planets are indeed, as the shloka tells us, in the very last sentence, and it's interesting that this final sentence in shloka 1, she puts in quotation marks. Rather interesting. It's really not so much from the shloka as she says, adds the commentary. So that in one sense, she has put as part of the shloka, part of the occult commentary, and that says, they are all dragons of wisdom. And this is because these seven sacred planets are indeed dragons, that is to say, and she deals with this term, every mythology has its dragons. These are the wise ones, the Nagas, in Indian tradition. And so the serpent or dragon stood for the achievement of wisdom. And these are dragons of wisdom. In an essay on pagan sidereal worship or astrology, in volume 5, page 328, HPB tells us that all the classical authors and philosophers who have treated the subject repeat with Hermes Trismegistus that the seven rectors, the planets, including the sun, were the associates or the co-workers of the unknown all represented by the Demiurgos, commissioned to contain the cosmos, our planetary world, within seven circles. This doctrine of Hermes was that of Pythagoras and of Orpheus before him. Now it's interesting, during the medieval period in Europe, there was a great deal about these seven spheres. And of course, Dante in the Divina Commedia has the various spheres, you see, through which, of course, human souls progress and so on. And Dante, of course, I think was one of the wise people, undoubtedly an initiate of the wisdom in many respects. And one has in many other representations in some of the very early medieval alchemical works, there are drawings of these spheres. Very interesting to see. And so, as she says, these treat again and again the seven rectors, the planets, including the sun, were the associates or the co-workers of the unknown all, dragons of wisdom. This, it seems to me, is also another reason why the Earth is not included among the seven planets, sacred planets, simply because our humanity, therefore, under this Dhyani, has not reached that stage of being one of the dragons of wisdom. But perhaps in some further Mahamanvantara, this may be achieved. When we have achieved, and therefore have helped the Dhyani of our system to achieve, a further stage in evolution. I mean, sometimes I think we make it very tough for him. If I can anthropomorphize this law of our globe, I think we make it very tough for him.
Her.
To get on with her achievement. But because we mess things up. Because we do have choice, as you said. We have choice of what we will do.
The sun now, you're talking about the sun as being the law of our globe?
Of our globe. Mm-hmm. Of the whole system.
Of the whole system.
Well, it gave life to the first, and in one sense, you see, as representative of that, which then also, and this is one of the mysteries which I haven't figured out, and somebody else may have, in one sense, this becomes Venus as the light bearer to our globe, you see, which is intimately connected with Lucifer.
Mm-hmm. But see, the sun is supposed to be
of our solar universe.
So it must be when you talk about the law of the
globe.
Uh-huh. It would be
it's the sort
of the world.
Yes, the Lord of
so
the world in that sense.
Of the sun.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. I hate to echo a question from the other day, but where's the solar logos?
Well, then it would be the solar logos would be in terms of the total chain, but when I say the law of this globe, the watcher, the Lord of the world, the watcher, who is the representative of the solar logos for our globe. Does this make sense?
Yeah. Talks about this,
yes,
about the correspondence between the monad,
mm-hmm,
the Lord of the
world,
and
the solar logos.
Yes,
yes, yes. Dr. Timey in Man, God, and the Universe speaks of that relationship.
Are the associations between the sacred planets and the globes characteristic?
Yes, I think so. Now, this is the way, and this is taken from Barborka, which is a summary, of course, of what we have in the secret doctrine, and so I simply took it from him. Now, HPB is clear that the sun and the moon are substitutes for two unnamed of the sacred planets. These, she says, are substitutes. What is meant by that?
The Barborka.
Well, Vulcan and Minerva might be the substitute.
They may be the substitute. It's hard to say.
Do you think it's because the sun and moon have other...
It may well be because they have other responsibilities But that it, she again and again says, substitute for that which is too mysterious to be named, such a thing. So that's all, you know, I mean, I really haven't figured it out. But of course, in India, this is called Surya. Here's the astrological symbol, said to be, therefore, responsible for globe A, particularly for globe A. Brihaspati, Jupiter, for globe B. And here, several names are given. Ushanas Shukra, or Loitanga, Venus, and at times she talks about Venus Lucifer. And of course we have in the, oh yes, it's time for to break, but we have in the second shloka, which is the real plea, where the earth is saying, Lord of the shining face, which is the sun, my house is empty, send thy sons to people this wheel, which is earth. Thou hast sent thy seven sons to the Lord of wisdom. Seven times doth he see thee nearer to himself. Seven times more doth he feel thee. And of course, the Venus is the planet, second in distance from the sun, and said to be, therefore, much closer. So, but Venus is also often identified with Lucifer, who is the light bringer, and therefore there is a very intimate connection. And this is globe C, which is immediately preceding ours, globe D, Shani or Krura Ohana, Saturn, responsible for globe D, Mercury, as or Buddha with the 1D, globe E, beyond us therefore, Angaraka, Mars, globe F, and Soma, the moon, for globe G. Now this is the way in which HPB delineates them. Now this can also, of course, refer, I think, to the seven regions, and this the seven primordial groups, reflecting then on from the moon chain the seven primordial groups, each to his allotted part of our globe, the simultaneous evolution of seven human groups. And so picturing them this way, one can see that these could be, I would think, correlated with the rays. Well, think about that while you have a cup of coffee.
Theory, now you can take it or leave it, you know, but having studied the secret doctrine a long time ago and going into this, I've puzzled over it for a lot of years, because I feel that at the time that she was writing a lot of this down, as you have probably surmised too, people were not ready for everything that could come out later. And so the sun and the moon, of course, do stand in even ordinary astrology. Mm-hmm. They're not planets, we know that. And so her idea of including them in the sacred planets is not unusual, because they are representing something that at the time people were not ready to understand. So my feelings are that actually the principles that those things represent is what they're trying to really mm-hmm. bring out.
Mm-hmm.
And humanity has to develop the principle within themselves before they can understand what that really means. So they wouldn't dare bring out what the planets really were at that time, because people really wouldn't tune in on it. As mm-hmm. we know from the Mahatma letters too, a lot of things
mm-hmm.
are hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And as humanity grows and develops, then it makes some more sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that the other planets that are not mentioned could easily be those sacred planets that are representing principles which humanity hasn't fully developed.
That would be particularly Neptune or Uranus and Pluto.
Right. See, those things have mm-hmm. very hidden meanings.
Yes.
And even the most modern astrologers will admit
mm-hmm.
to that we can give it some sort of a meaning
mm-hmm.
now, but we really don't know
mm-hmm.
all the things that
mm-hmm.
they contain.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that those are the sacred planets.
Mm-hmm.
but they just didn't bring it into the scheme because people wouldn't really tune in on it and understand what that means. We still know very little.
We still know very little. Of course, she has a footnote about, because it's only Pluto that has been discovered in comparatively recent times.
Yeah, but in astrology, even at that time, they seldom used Neptune.
Oh, I know it. But they were known, and she has a footnote that they were known, and this is not referring to them.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I kind of feel that they are. I have a feeling that...
Of course, they are. I agree with you. They're very mysterious planets, and every astrologer seems to indicate they have a... The connection is a very... mysterious,
subtle
one,
thing.
Subtle.
Well, having read a very good article on how when each of those three far away planets were discovered, something phenomenal also happened to humanity, which was like something opening a door.
Yes.
And so it was sort of like awakening a principle within the people, which is still in a very baby-like stage, which they don't fully understand at all.
Yes.
And so those things are meant to be happening sometime in the future when we can grasp what the real meaning is.
Yeah.
But I have really pondered over that quite a bit. And of course, all planets mean principles. When you were mentioning tuning in on the heavenly body that's behind the planet, that's what we're tuning in on the inside of us.
Yes, that's right.
And above, so below, the principle has
and
to be
so
developed.
And so all of these seven in that sense, which are the seven groups, are within us, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. That's what they really mean. See, we can't really shake our fists at any of those planets and say, hey, what are you doing to me? Because it's what we have done to ourselves. We have developed a principle within ourselves to the point of where it sets the pattern going. And then the planets above just simply are telling us that. So we can't be mad at anybody but ourselves.
Thank you, Ben. Hindu names, Sanskrit terms, are all very ancient. This, in that sense, was part of the Hindu mythological tradition very much, and therefore the Hindu esoteric tradition very much in that sense. Diane?
Just a comment on also relating your question about, or your comment about consciousness. Jung had talked about in astrology as the planets and the influences and the principles that they represent, has also built up in humanity in what he terms the collective unconscious.
Yes.
And so it's their influence very strongly over centuries, thousands and thousands of years. But when you take a look at the other planets that were more recently discovered, they haven't had as much time to sort of develop meaning within that collective unconscious. So that one of the reasons why they do remain more mysterious.
Yes.
That there just hasn't been enough.
Yes. Jung became very interested, you know, may know. He said that he never went into it fully, and it was really through Mrs. Jung. Emma Jung became extremely interested in astrology and studied it quite deeply, and really is the one that influenced him to use some astrological correlations in his work on synchronicity. But she was the one that was really quite influential in that and quite a student of it. Thurley tells me that she has done a quite elaborate study on the sevens, which I think is very interesting. You said you found some 30?
Oh yes, I have a whole page of correspondences.
You say about 35?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Which I think is fascinating, because it's marvelous to begin to see how
seven
this...
Seven layers of the skin, seven this, seven that.
Seven that, yeah, very wonderful.
Maybe our access code to the computer in the sky.
There we are. There we are. Well, there's very much... there's another very interesting, this is sort of an aside, but a very interesting and quite fascinating statement found in that same section of pagan sidereal worship or astrology. Yes. that is quite fascinating. I failed to get the exact reference, but it's in that section. There, in which HBB comments, this is the comment I was looking for, on why Uranus is not named among the seven sacred planets, indicating that this is a modern name, and then she adds, "One thing is certain, the ancients had a planet, a mystery planet, that they never named, and that the highest astronomus, the Hierophant, alone could confabulate with. But this seventh planet was not the sun, but the hidden divine Hierophant. In the archaic system of the Hindus, the sun is the visible logos, Surya. Over him there is another, the divine or heavenly man, who, after having established the system of the world of matter on the archetype of the unseen universe or macrocosm, conducted during the mysteries the heavenly Rasa Mandala." This is a very interesting. And during that Rasa Mandala, when he said, "To give with his right foot the impulse to Bhumi," which is the earth, B-H-U-M-I, Bhumi, "to give with his right foot the impulse to Bhumi that makes included," and one can assume that there must be a valid reason, perhaps that which Bim has suggested, perhaps there are other reasons. I think we have to really consider it from an esoteric point of view, why these were not. "And while the sun and the moon are included," as HBB says, "as substitutes for esoteric purposes, she also designates them as heavenly parents," as I've already quoted, referring, of course, to the fact that our parentage is really twofold from this point of view. It's twofold. It's multiple from other points of view, but certainly basically twofold. The solar petries, the fathers, which gave the monastic stimulus, and the lunar petries, the fathers, providing the model or shadow body. So we have this, and of course Barborka in the Peopling of the Earth gives us the names of the sacred planets in the Chaldean system, which I haven't put up, but you can see them there. And HBB, of course, uses several of the Sanskrit terms, linking them with the more familiar names that we use from Latin. Now, let's continue for a moment the quotation to which I referred earlier. This is volume 1, pages 575 and 576. And let me read it. It's a fairly long quotation, but I think it helps. She says, "In order to avoid creating new misconceptions, let it be stated that among the three secret orbs or star angels, neither Uranus nor Neptune entered." Now this indicates she was aware these had been discovered before she wrote the secret doctrine. "Not only because they were unknown under these names to the ancient sages, but because they, as all other planets, however many there may be, are the gods and guardians of other septenary chains of globes within our systems." Yes, they have it, I think, at times been referred to as captive within our system. But that's an interesting point for us. You see, she's saying they were unknown under those names, of course, but they were they are gods and guardians of other septenary chains of globes within our systems. "There are details," then she continues, "there are details which, on account of their great metaphysical abstractions, cannot be entered upon. Hence, we merely state that only seven of our planets are as intimately related to our globe as the sun is to all the bodies subject to him in his system. That comes back to what you pointed out, Arlene. Of these bodies, the poor little number of primary and secondary planets known to astronomy looks wretched enough, in truth. Therefore, it stands to reason that there are a great number of planets, small and large, that have not been discovered yet, but of the existence of which ancient astronomers, all of them initiated adepts, must have certainly been aware. But as their relation to the gods was sacred, it had to remain arcane, as also the names of various other planets and stars. Very fascinating passage, and that's why I felt I should read it in toto, because I think it's very interesting. Now, of course, Barborka, in the Divine Plan, treats of this doctrine of the seven sacred planets at some length, and also in his Peopling of the Earth, he correlates, as we have done, the seven sacred planets with the globes of the Earth chain, following the enumeration given by H.P.B. in her commentary on the second shloka, which we have yet to consider, of course, but we can just bring it in here because it helps us to understand this. This is volume 2, page 29. Like each of the seven regions of the earth, each of the seven firstborn, the primordial human groups, receives its light and life from its own especial dhyani, spiritually, and from the palace, house, the planet, of that dhyani, physically. So with the seven great races to be born on it. The first is born under the sun, the second under Brihaspati, Jupiter, the third under Loetanga, the fiery-bodied Venus, or Shukra, the fourth under Soma, the sun, the moon, our globe also, the fourth sphere being born under and from the moon, and Shani, Saturn, the Krura Lohana, evil-eyed, and the Asita, the dark, and fifth under Buddha, Mercury. So you have the various root races, the globes, again a correspondence throughout. And Barborka provides us with the chart, which I have already put up there. And each one of these, then, is a seven, each one of the seven sacred planets is, in a sense, a planetary chain. That is, each planetary chain consists of seven globes. And the seven planets are the sacred planets of antiquity, and all are septenary. H.P.B. says that, page 167 of volume 2. So each one is septenary. Now, Thurley has raised a question which I had carefully avoided mentioning, but I better be honest enough to mention it, and that is Deepuruker speaks of 10. And I really have not
and
been able...
And subsequently of 12.
And subsequently of 12.
Excuse me, 10 what?
10 planets, not in connection with the seven sacred planets, but... and I didn't bring the reference because I didn't understand it well enough at all. But does he indicate there's 10 sacred planets or 10?
No, I think...
No. Still the seven sacred planets, but then he names...
Puts five above the line.
First
they start out with 10 and then he finally raises it to 12.
To 12. So it is something I really do not understand, I must admit.
That's interesting because there are 10... chakras, mm-hmm. which set the
dominant. Yes. So it may have a relation to that. We say there are seven planetary chains, but that there are three others beyond, of which we have no knowledge, so it may relate to 10 planetary chains. The Pythagorean system, of course, was based on the decad, 10. So it may be that, and of course, the original, am I right, the original astrological horoscope was 10, and then two were divided, making it 12.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm?
12 houses.
12 houses, but there were 10 originally, weren't
yes.
there?
Yeah. Yes.
And then two, which were the two?
Well, they cut Virgo, if I recall correctly.
Yes, I think so. Leo and Libra. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. In any event, so there, of course, all of these numbers are meaningful without question.
There's also the decade in the Kabbalah. And
yes. The Sephiroth tree. The Sephiroth tree.
The three dominant two.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
From which all the others come.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so there is that, in the Sephiroth tree. So again, we have the 3, the 7 and the 10, and 7 and 10 and 12.
I read in some places, he put, if I recall correctly, De Kruger put the 5 physical senses on those.
Yes.
Imposed, okay, and I mm-hmm. have some other references, I forget whose work it is, in which we have 12 physical senses on the 5.
There have been... That's interesting.
Sort of like, yes. All 12 of them yes. suddenly get alive when they'd be literally on our knees overwhelmed.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Uh-huh. And of course, HPB says there's 7 in terms of the 7 root races, 1 per developmental stage, 7 states of consciousness, of course, she refers to in the esoteric writings, and so on.
We've got a long way to go. Mm-hmm.
We have a long way to go. Well, a couple of more points that I'd like to get in if we can. Now, I've already commented about the Earth and why the Earth is not among the sacred planets. Barborka makes this statement, this is in the Divine Plan, page 228, that this mystification, that is, as to why Earth is not among the sacred planets, is due more to the fact that there is a confusion in the mind in regard to the purpose of the enumeration. Also, the full significance of the meaning of the 7 sacred planets is not understood. It is not a question of naming the recognized planets, nor is it a matter of enumerating the planets which are subservient to the sun, or to use the esoteric term, the solar law or solar logos. It is rather a means of indicating the planetary laws who are especially linked to the Earth. This means the planets which assisted us, assisted in, or are responsible for the building of the Earth chain. One planet of the 7 having a special surveillance of one of the 7 globes of the terrene chain. And that's why the globes are given there, as well as one planet watching over one of the 7 races of our Earth, Globe D. So I felt that his explanation was perhaps extremely helpful and useful to us. So we have both an actual linking or interrelationship between one of the sacred planets and one of the globes of our chain, a linking that means actually giving assistance in the fashioning of the globe by the dhyani of the sacred planet concerned, and also a direct linking between that dhyani and the beings who are pursuing their evolutionary pilgrimage on a particular globe. So it's an inner and outer relationship. And further, there's a linking of the monads as well as the vestures or principles which the monadic essence utilizes with the particular planetary dhyani concerned. And again, Barborka elucidates this point rather clearly on page 247 and succeeding pages of the Divine Plan. He says, considering the vestures which the monads require for their residence upon a sphere, these vestures are the habiliments appropriate to the globe or sphere upon which the monad becomes stationed. Thus, during his stay on Earth, the vestures represent the principles of which man is constituted. In the case of the Earth globe, on which the monad is temporarily stationed during Earth life, the principles have been transmitted to the Earth by means of the planetary dhyanis who have supervision over the seven sacred planets. And that's why they've been transmitted through, because we came from the lunar planetary chain. Of course, the status of the monads on the Earth globe represents what they have been able to unroll or to bring into development during their evolutionary stay upon the sphere. Just as the dhyanis of the seven sacred planets are watchers over the seven globes of the Earth chain, one dhyani having particular surveillance over one globe and likewise over one race, in similar manner, the dhyanis of the seven sacred planets act as primaries over the seven principles of man. One planetary dhyani for each principle. So again, there's a correlation between the principles and these seven sacred planets.
Joy, I might be stating the obvious, but then again, it just struck me. Has it occurred to you that these influences are alternating?
Could be.
They're alternating between inner and outer planets.
Oh, I see. Yes, I see what you mean.
I don't know.
Yes. That may well be. I hadn't thought of that.
So you see,
Sun,
then outer Jupiter, then the inner planet Venus, outer Saturn, Mercury, outer Mars, and back to
That's an interesting point, yes.
She also put some numbers on. Mercury is 7 times stronger in the sun's emanation. The Earth, and Venus is 2 times.
Yes.
But she doesn't give numbers for Jupiter.
No, she doesn't.
Mercury and Venus are in the inner circle between the Earth and the Sun. So our minds are being changed by the constant revolution of all planets. Is that sort of long?
Very interesting. You can see there's a great deal in this. Well, we'll have, of course, cause to return to this when we come to the second shloka. But it, of course, doesn't end here. We have to return to the question of why the Earth is not named among the seven sacred planets and anticipate its future role by recognizing that the Earth chain, with its seven globes, actually is to act in the capacity of a sacred planet, along with 6 other planetary chains, each with its 7 globes, in assisting to build another system of 7 globes comprising another planetary system or chain. I've already said that, but I'm repeating it because I think it's important here. So it may be suggested, you see, that we have a rather serious responsibility before us in terms of the evolution of our planet and the life it embodies, so that in due time this planet may serve its role, not as it the Earth is now, but as it is to be, as it were, by the end of the 7th round, the 7th race of the 7th round, for a future system of worlds. And it will be comprised, and this comes back to what you said, Diane, of the collective consciousness, or the collective unconscious of Jung, when this is built in. This will be a characteristic, then, that will assist in the building of future planetary chains. And that will be composed also of what we do with this planet and how we treat it. Well, there's so very much more concerning this doctrine, of course, of the seven sacred planets, many more references throughout the secret doctrine than I've put together for today, and we'll of course have cause to refer to it a number of times in our studies. There is, as is quite obvious, a close connection between then each of these 7 planets and the Earth, as well as with our humanity, so through the 7 rounds of this Earth chain and through the 7 root races which we undergo in this present 4th round. The subject becomes very complicated at times, and very much of it is not given to us. I think we can take heart from the statement made by HPB in Volume 1 when she refers to Mars, Mercury, and 4 other planets, and this is page 164 of volume 1, adding, they bear a relation to earth of which no master or high occultist will ever speak, much less explain the nature. And then in a footnote there, she refers, of course, to a letter from one of the adept teachers to Mr. Sinnott. In the Mahatma Letters, it's on page 177, in which the Mahatma K.H. tells Sinnott, try to understand that you are putting me questions pertaining to the highest initiations. And this had to do with the planetary chains and the planets. That I can give you only a general view, but that I dare not enter upon details. And at the same time, of course, HBB's commentary on the second shloka, to which we'll have to turn our attention eventually, contains a number of references to Mercury and Venus. And this, of course, is very interesting because I was asked, you see, why is it that Lucifer has become the Christian devil? You know. And she goes into this, you see. And it's very interesting because, of course, the name Lucifer means light bearer, or light maker, light bearer, one who generates light and bears light and conveys light, you see. And it's interesting because there's a very close connection with Venus Lucifer. Of course, Mercury, she says, is still more occult and mysterious than Venus, but she says Venus is the most occult, powerful, and mysterious of all the planets. The one whose influence upon and relation to the Earth is the most prominent. And then she adds a very interesting statement from the occult commentary. Every sin committed on Earth is felt by Usana Sukra, Venus. That's something. The guru of the daityas is the guardian spirit of the earth and men. Every change on Sukra is felt on and reflected by the earth. Now this we'll have to get into very much more because it deals with what has been called the Luciferian evolution. But she points out, you see, of course, Lucifer was the bright and morning star of the Old Testament, as you know. And then, of course, the whole allegory dealing with Lucifer and the whole question of, in fact, in the myth, There's a marvelous myth in which Tara, the priest's wife, is carried off by the moon and by Soma, and all sorts of things happen in the myth. I'm trying to skip some of this, but out of this, because Lucifer helped Soma against this ancient personification of ritualistic worship is now depicted as Satan, the enemy of God. And in some of the early symbologies, Lucifer or Venus is depicted as a globe with horns. And it's that horned deity, so to speak, which of course has been taken over by the Christians as Satan, and Lucifer as Satan, and the enemy, therefore, of God. So it's very interesting, and of course it's been, therefore, brought down. And yet here, and of course she says, one can trace the biographies of all the planets by the history of their gods and rulers. So one would have to turn to mythology for the history of their gods and rulers, you see. And then you begin to see. And Usana's, or Venus, is the bosom friend of Soma, The foe of Jupiter, who is the instructor of the gods, whose wife Tara had been carried away by the moon, of whom he begat Buddha, took also an active part in this war against the gods, and then was degraded into the Asura, the demon, and so remains to this day as Satan, of course. Rather interesting, because it's the fall, but the fall into generation. And consequently, the symbol of Venus is the reverse, isn't it, of the Earth?
Yeah.
Isn't that right? Because the Earth symbol is the sphere with the this, isn't it?
I thought the Earth had the cross inside.
Yeah, that's
or the Earth has
the cross inside of it.
Yes, that's right. No, it does. It has the cross.
Mars is the reverse of Venus.
Yes, Mars is the reverse of Venus.
No,
Mercury has come to be the one with the horns.
Yeah.
And Mercury, she says, although she says Venus is the most mysterious, then she says even more so is Mercury. You see. Mm-hmm. And so the two are often, but she goes into the symbolism at times too.
In the secret doctrine gives the reverse of Venus as the Earth symbol.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Yes.
Because there are, this was originally the Earth symbol, which was simply
the other way.
Yes, the other way, I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
So that this is the fall, this now has that above us, as it were. And so now generation.
It relates to the male and female.
It relates to the male and female,
yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Symbols, yes. Very much so.
When you were speaking about Venus Lucifer as bearing the symbol of the Earth, I was thinking of that symbology.
Mm-hmm.
In Venus, that the circle is raised above the cross.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The spirit checked
like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's very much more, as you can see, to explore in it. But it's fascinating, isn't it? And,
it occurs to me that on the physical level, I've always been very skeptical of some of these influences, because the only thing that you could see on the physical level was very weak interplay of gravitational forces, which is universal throughout the solar system and not differential.
Mm-hmm.
But it occurs to me, of course, that modern cosmology has given us a different view of the origin of the planetary system, where the formation of the rings of debris followed a resonance. Happen.
Oh, yes.
So, we know the resonances can fall into groups of seven.
Uh-huh.
So that's the first point. Secondly, all the material was at once associated together, and under Bell's theorem, are you with me now? I refer to Bell's theorem where a primary particle such as an electron being associated together, adopting the same spin, when they're separated by any distance, anything that affects one affects the other, no matter what the distance.
No matter what the distance.
At the other end of the universe.
Yes. No matter the distance. Distance has no relation.
That's right.
Yes.
So very much so within the solar system, of course, we are exposed to the fact that electrons that make up our very being could be paired with electrons from some other planetary system.
Yes, I think that's a very interesting point that this would have relation to, that because distance is irrelevant in Bell's theorem.
I don't know what it all means.
I don't know what it means. I hope somebody knows what it means.
In that case, time would be irrelevant.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And that's why the synchronicity, because time, it's atemporal.
So globe A in a former chain would, in a way, influence globe A of a subsequent chain would influence.
That's
the expression actually, thoroughly under Bell's theorem, is acausal.
Acausal.
Because you can only have causation where there's a physical connection between two objects.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas under Bell's theorem,
there's no physical
between the two particles.
Yes.
So it's acausal and totally inexplicable.
Mm-hmm. And so time then does become irrelevant. It is our temporal because it is our causal.
Well, that's right. Well, thinking at the moment is that holistic, of course, in there's no such thing as a multitude of electron particles, but only one electron in the entire universe. Right. What we see as multiple electrons are emergences of the one electron density.
Yes. Very interesting. This is where physics is, of course, really rather exciting at the frontier edge, cutting edge.
And Bohm draws the conclusion, but not all physicists do. They have different schools of physics apparently do not have a consensus about the unity of the physical plane or whatever. But Bohm is one of those who does say that for him this non-locality is synonymous with unity.
Yes. Bohm extrapolates a great deal from that position. Yes. this is why it's useful in reading Jung's essay on synchronicity. It's usually published, and the only way I've ever seen it published is along with Pauli's essay on complementariness in physics. And the two, but are causal. Well, much to think about, John.
In Anna's class, she tried to bring up, all of these various ideas, including the idea of interdependency and so forth, and all of this. But, it seems that we have this tremendous battle, because when you think about our physical body, our sight, things get smaller as they get further away from us. In other words, it centers, our sight is helping to center our consciousness on ourselves. Hearing is the same way. All of these senses and so forth, which are just other, aspects or indications or whatever. The fact is that each one of us is really the center of the universe and our consciousness.
Yes.
And, it's like we're really this isolated thing. And isn't it true that in the sacred doctrine it talks about, evolution as being something that is really an individual affair?
Yes.
Proposition.
Oh, yes.
Yet, we're trying to reach out and have, a global consciousness and a global humanity and everything. But the fact is, each one of us is really very independent and responsible for our own evolution, ultimately.
Oh, yes.
And it's like,
that's the way
the planet is made.
There's
no way you're going to get around being the center of your own universe.
That's right. Needleman makes this very clear, Jacob Needleman, whose work I admire tremendously, in a little book called The Sense of the Cosmos. And it's a delightful little work and well worth reading, and points out that it's not that the ancients were not aware of the heliocentric system, but for a very valid philosophical reason, emphasized the geocentric. Which is really ultimately anthropocentric, so that, as you say, but the interconnection is also there, so that whatever I do with my consciousness has an effect on the consciousness of all.
It's a participatory universe.
So I may be independent, but I certainly have an effect on everything.
I'm talking about the primary focus of consciousness.
Oh, yes. That's right. Yes.
I don't know how you can get the quality of that, of course.
Isn't this why, was it Schrödinger, said that consciousness is the singular of which the plural is unknown?
I think what's fascinating is about this participatory idea that all this seem to be token is when you so several times stress that in developing themselves, these planets were that in developing, in our developing ourselves, we were permitting the development of the planet in relation
yes.
to us.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. Mm-hmm. Yes. It really it leads to so many ideas, doesn't it? Well, tomorrow we'll continue, and I'm going to give you a little change of pace, but also take up a bit of Earth's sad complaint.